Hello, and welcome back to another round of What's That Stain on My Floor with me, Emmett Lewis, and my glorious co-host, Mikael Christiansen. How are things going, Mikael?
Yeah, what is that stain on the floor? What
I don't know, but if it's not, if I haven't got my hands placed at the right point either side of that stain, I'm not going to balance.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. yeah, how are things going? That's the usual question. Yeah, 3.6 rankings again. Not great, not terrible. At home, folding paper. What else do I have to say? Nothing. Been at home for a while, but soon back on kind of little bit on the road with some shows and stuff in Norway next time.
Yeah.
Little around during March. Then it actually kind of starts to look like spring over here, and holy fuck, I have become a full degen during February, and it happens every year. Like, okay, now I'm going to describe the feeling of February in Scandinavia in a very succinct way. The feeling is like this. Ah, shit. I should have vacuum cleaned 2 weeks ago. That's the feeling. That is literally the feeling of February up here. Like, you're just done. It's just empty, and you have nothing left. And then you just turn, full,
themed mode. I think it's that, I can't remember the Finnish word for it. They have a specific word for when you're sitting at home drinking in your underwear.
I know that word. It's kalsari, can't it? apparently. Kalsari, I think. Anyone Finnish here, and I'm butchering your language, I apologize. And I'm not going to even try to, actually understand the grammar of this, because it's Finnish, space language, but kalsari, I think, means underwear, and kännit is kind of like drinking or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a pretty powerful phrase.
Basically, any sort of group of nations that has to come up with a phrase like that, and you understand immediately what it means. You're just like, yeah, I get you. I understand. Winter was a bit long.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yep. We'll just deal with it, or maybe not. So, yeah. What's going on with me?
Yeah, but it's now 3 o'clock and there's still sun outside. Like, it's actually blue skies and stuff. That's pretty sick. And I'm not that far north. I mean, I'm in Stockholm. It's not far north.
Yeah.
So, but still, it was usually sunset here at this time, some weeks ago. So, thank God something is happening. That is basically it. How are you in the cathedral?
Yeah, it's pretty good. Just last week has been mad in terms of doing stuff. It's like kind of spring has sprung, and now it's doing stuff. We got a, what do we do? We've done a trip to IKEA, which is hell.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, definitely. Get a lot of stuff to make the dorms here. I have decorated my office, which right now it just looks like I'm sitting in the dark, but I'm not. I don't think that is cool, and that will that means I'm going to be able to film some more stuff with a quicker turnaround in talking style, which would be nice for other stuff. Other than that, I'd like to say amazing things have happened. I'm driving my Bugattis and they're blue in color, but I'm not, because let's face it. Other than that.
Instead, you have a dog that ate the sock, didn't you?
Yeah. Did I tell that story in the last one?
No, you didn't. You told it to me briefly, but I need more details.
I don't know if you do need more details, but anyway. So Albus, the Dumble Dog, he went to his crate. He sleeps in a crate overnight. And I got there in the morning, and it looked like he'd pooped in the crate. He doesn't poop in his crate. The only time it happens is if he's got a sick stomach, he's got diarrhea, and that's very rare. But I was like, that's a turd. I was like, thanks, dog. That's the thing I need to do before my coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So got him out of his crate and then cleaned it. And when I went to pick it up, it turned out it was a sock. And I'm pretty certain there's two options here. One, he could have eaten it and swallowed it, but it was very turd-shaped and kind of twisted around itself with pointy ends. So I'm pretty certain my dog ate a sock, swallowed it, digested it, and then gave himself a sock colonic. So, yeah, that was, it's one of those things, just like, I don't even know where he got it, because, like, he does rob stuff around the house that was on the floor, but he wants you to chase him. So he must have got that sock and just fucking scarfed it down so fast. And, like, yeah, I don't know, but, you know, it's what dogs do, apparently. They eat socks. And then, yeah. You know, yeah.
Must feast.
I'm just glad he didn't, like, half poop it out and I had to pull the rest out.
Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, God. Okay, I don't need more details. I think we good. Yeah. I think we're great. As usual, there is a topic far in there. And yes, we're basically continuing from last week, because the book that we're talking about, and if you are listening to this and you haven't listened to the previous episode, I suggest you do, just for context, but we will just begin by giving like a brief summary of what it is. It's The True Art and Science of Hand Balancing, written first in 1931 by Professor P.H. Polinetti, at that time very famous hand balancer from the U.S. What did he say? It was like Irish and Irish, something. Italian.
I think he's kind of one of these people in the States who just, you know, I'm one quarter everything.
Mm-hmm.
Got like six quarters of something in there,
but we are talking proper old school. He was in his the peak of his performing career in the like early 1900s, like,
yeah.
There are posters in the book of like what are those kind of pictures called on it?
The like olden day camera ones done with like the box camera that you have to. Like...
Well, I was thinking of the poster that's kind of very far up in the.
Lithograph.
Yeah, lithograph, exactly. Yeah. So like, you can kind of see the ones that have like probably been on like billboards and stuff to advertise, and he's the only man in the world who does the this and that, and like you see him in these various costumes and like with a mustache and being. All honorable and glorious gentleman lookish, and with the very arched back handstand, which we have discussed and will discuss more about today, because it's a very relevant topic to the episode. So we're basically continuing from like more or less halfway down the book, going through different chapters and kind of just a little bit of the content of it, basically, and discussing various topics around that.
Yeah, so we got to chapter 3 last time. We finished chapter 3 out, if you're following along at home. We're starting on to chapter 4. We're not going to read too much of the paragraphs this time, unless they're relevant. And this is the kind of thing, this book was co-authored by a guy, Bob L. Jones, Robert L. Jones, who was a beast in his own right. And he added stuff in. The original version didn't have a lot of these texts in it, but this got added in. So co-authored or joint authored Lee or some other stuff. So he was a guy who, his power move was standing on 5 like bowling pins or juggling clubs, I'm not sure what they were, and then he'd do a fingertip handstand on them, or 5 on each hand. Then he'd knock them out one by one for dramatic thing, pausing on like a finger and a thumb, and then knock out the last ones. Now, and then finish in a thumb handstand. So we've all seen these Shaolin masters, one finger Zen, and that kind of stuff, when they're like, I'm doing a handstand on a finger, but I'm using the wall. Well, this guy was the Shaolin Grandmaster.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, just to clarify, like, the last kind of clubs he was standing on, like, it specifically says they were nailed to the ground, of course, because if they weren't and you're doing a thumb stand, you're going to eat massive amounts of shit.
I don't know how long it took him to find out that they needed to be nailed there.
True. I'm sure he was experimenting. I mean, like, they were really trying, like, because it's like back in these days when, like, from what they describe, it's very interesting to kind of, as a kind of scope into the past, how they looked at things. Like, they're not using the word circus artist, because but that's what they were. Like, they were performers professionally, but they used the word gymnast a lot. As I assume that, based on what we can read here, that's just like the term that they were using about what they were doing. But yeah, well, like a lot it's of it interesting was
because gymnastics as a sport wouldn't really been around then.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
so that came a bit later in history. So they're probably using gymnast in the term, like, you know, a classical education, people would know a bit of Greek, and we know gymnastics comes from the Greek phrase. I can't remember the exact translation, but it basically translates as to exercise naked.
Yeah.
So, and then it is a thing in the physical culture. Like, if you look at these old physical culture manuals, you were instructed to exercise in your underwear because it was healthier for the skin to breathe. Now, it probably makes sense when you're wearing, like, you know, Victorian clothing. It's like, I have a shirt, an undershirt, a waistcoat, a heavy wool coat, a heavier coat. Now, they like to wear clothes in Victorian era. So, you know, it's probably pretty good to get out and get your skin exposed. But then again, maybe it was a bit this is the thing. Fitness, this kind of thing is always a bit racy. Like, we know it nowadays. You go on Instagram, you just basically see people's genitalia, and that's what they're doing. And basically, that's what you see here. It's kind of like, oh, no. I'm not naked, but I need to be in my underwear to show off my feet. So just don't forget that. People have been exercising in the underwear for quite a while. People are complaining about people being in the underwear in a gym. Well, just do as your grandfather done. Strip down to your Y-fronts. So this kind of these kind of chapters following on aren't so technical in other stuff. They're more anecdotal, kind of... Anecdote isn't the real word there. It's kind of story time, like telling what led up to it, like what inspired it. And it is kind of interesting just on the inspiration thing. It's like, oh, there was people doing it on, you know, handstand on three fingers, and I thought I could do better. So there's this kind of like collaborative outdoing, which is kind of quite common. It's not so common nowadays in circus, but it was back then of like, ah, he done tight wire across this building. Well, I'll do tight wire across this building, and I'll, you know, he went over the Niagara Falls in a barrel. Well, I'll go over with no barrel. This kind of one-upmanship was always quite prevalent. So it is kind of, it is just that, like, yeah, you know, if you look at
yeah, like they do describe that a lot in these books. Like, a lot of the book, like we mentioned before, last time too, it's very like, it's a lot of love letter to Paulinetti and the great skills and the greatest of all time and the only man who could do this. Like, it seems like that was a lot the culture back then, and like, like there are many instances where they describe these kind of meetings of two great performers, and then the great Paulinetti outperforming the other with ease and stuff like that. So, like, there was that kind of competitive thing to it, because of course, if the industry of display had to do with with showing what had never been done before or something unbelievable, you needed to one up the next guy, basically.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny. I just want to touch on before we like get into the book material, that like what you said about gymnastics and that it became a sport much later, kind of like at least in the competitive and like proper technical aspects. Because right nowadays, like if you speak to almost anyone, like it's a common notion in culture, like popular culture, that gymnasts are some of the most like incredible athletes out there, which is true. Like they are some of the most absolutely peak trained possible humans that walk around. But if you look backwards in history, if you look at, for example, the high bar routines back in the 70s or 60s, or what was competed at the absolute peak level in like championships and stuff there, like it was quite tame compared to what you see nowadays. You'd basically see that, like, but if you look at the circus artists back in the 60s, a lot of the traditional circus like Russia and stuff like that, you see this like the same of that old tradition of trying to outdo what has been done before significantly. And you see these absolutely stupidly crazy things with like huge contraptions and like basically like to take like an example of one picture I have, there's a guy on a high wire, aka like a high wire is then like a tight wire, but that is very high up, obviously. The person walking across it has this very long stick that helps you balance. He has a guy doing a one arm on his head walking up there. And the guy who does the one arm on his head has a little girl standing on one foot on top of his neck.
Yeah.
So he does the one arm kind of arched, so she has like space for her foot to be. And he's one arming on top of a guy who's walking across a tight wire very high up in the air. So
no safeties, like, obviously.
Yeah, so this was the stuff. This was the business. This was what they did. So I find it very interesting to see the parallel development of gymnastics that has become more and more technically complex as the sport developed, and as they found what was the most powerful and effective techniques as the equipment changed, like the floor getting more springy, etc. Like gymnastics became... If you compare the circus and the gymnastics today, the gymnasts are more or less always the most proficient when it comes to just their raw physical skills. And you will very often, Cirque du Soleil and other big shows will take gymnasts and then put them into the circus. And the same with sport acrobatics, who are like the best flyers and hand balancers around, basically, because they have done the same skill set development, but in a sports context. So it's kind of been this like... and a very fascinating development, whereas the circus has gone a lot of kind of a performance and conceptual context and so on. But it's super interesting to just see when you look back at those times, kind of.
Yeah, I think someone in circus kind of nailed it for me. It was like, maybe it was you, actually, or someone. I think it's a general thinking anyway, where nowadays people, particularly in the West, are focusing more on the performance, the artistic elements, trying to take that to new directions. Because basically, the Chinese got so good that you can't beat them in the one-upping.
Mm-hmm.
Like, anything you think of doing, if it's new apparatus or something, Chinese circus will just, like, copy it and do it better.
Yeah, and that's happened a lot, actually, that, like, I either copied or just purchased the rights to... I mean, remember Kai Yong, right? With like the act on the white board. I mean, it is essentially like a photocopy of what
Anatoly Zalewski.
It's Zalewski, but like, but done differently. And I don't know if there is any like rights there, because it's just different enough so that it's not a copy. But you can very clearly see more than the influence.
Yeah. Spinning moves, same floor, splits a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Then Kai Yong is just a better hand balancer.
Yeah, exactly. Like then he's just like one of the best to ever have walked the planet. So then like, okay, well that's kind of their what they have up their sleeve in a way.
So anyway, back on to Bob and his two finger stand, two thumb stand, Shaolin Grandmaster Bob. So there's one interesting thing on Bob's development here. I think I can't read that out. So he joined the local Y, the YMCA, Young Men's Christian Association, where you go down and do wholesome physical culture activities, which we obviously know from the popular song, YMCA, by the Village People. Not an allusion to some of the things that might have happened in the YMCA when it was just young men exercising in their underwear. And this is kind of one of the things, actually, just to slightly step aside, is like, you know, there's always been a homosexual element to these physical cultures that gets ignored. And like, if someone wanted to do kind of anthropological or historical research into LGBT culture, and maybe it's been done already, it'd be a very interesting thing, because it's, you know, always depending on the tone of society at the moment, but these places were kind of places where people could meet up and, you know, meet like-minded people outside of the confines of, you know, society wouldn't, you know, obviously not be accepted and other stuff. So, sorry, just a brief segue. So that's why that song kind of gets that kind of nod in gay culture. But, you know, it is interesting stuff that is kind of like, you know, sexuality and alternate sexualities and other stuff were part of physical culture. These young, healthy bodies. It was one of the reasons the original Muscle Beach got shut down, because there was so much like fornicating and
degenerate.
It's gone degenerate, and that was one of the ends of it. So, you know, on both, like, you know, rumors, oh, there's men kissing men and other shit, and we've got to shut this shit down. But it is just an interesting segue there, just to point out. There's one thing, though. Bob joined the local YMCA. He liked the Roman rings. the original name of the rings was the Roman rings, and the Indeed. Original rings weren't rings, they were triangles. There's a bit of history for you. Anyway, so, and the basketball players kicked him out of the gym because they needed to take up all the space. So most handbouncers might relate to this one. A corner of the shower room was all the space available to, so he returned to his balancing interest. And on the tile floor, frequently wet with soap, he mastered most of his balance. There you go. Huh. Handbouncers in the corner doing their own thing.
Exactly. And that that's how it's been during all times, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen and everyone else. Like, that's how it is. Like, I'm sure all of you have been at the gym training. You know your legs are going to take a lot of space, so you cram yourself as far into a corner as possible. You know people are going to look at you and wonder what the fuck you're doing, but so you try to find the corner.
Yeah, literally. And you're stuck in the corner. There you go. Don't fall out and hit the wall. Don't slip on the floor. Another thing, first 2.5 years of Bob's real training were devoted to barbells for developmental work and a host of sports as an outlet for strength acquired. That's an interesting one, just like training and then having an outlet for your training. It's one of the things I encourage people in hand balance as well, and anything I coach people in, is your training is good, but if it doesn't actually really have a contextual usage, it just becomes a bit flaccid, I think, or a bit, you know, there's something else. There's something missing from your own human development or your physical development. Whereas if you're just like, oh, I'm getting splits. Why? So I can post pictures of me doing splits on Instagram. It's just a bit hollow.
It's interesting that, like, he says that stuff he says about the lifting weights there. Yeah. Like, and I'm going to take a mega segue to just speaking about this kind of old school culture here into another book that we might talk about at another occasion. Yeah. But there's a book called The York Hand Balancing Course, No. 1 and 2. These are also old books from kind of more or less like the same era, at least. Like, I think this one is from the 40s, if I'm not wrong. And I just want to read the first paragraph of this book, speaking of this with weights and this with false physical cultures. Because the first paragraph is so. Did you ever notice when you see a group of strong men together that sooner or later they take time out for some hand balancing? Hand balancing to a bodybuilder, a weightlifter, or any barbell man is as natural as a duck taking to water. I think one reason for this is the fact that barbell trained men are so much stronger than others that the difficult balancing stunts to them are very easy. Furthermore, lifting barbells has given the unusual coordination which is very necessary to the would-be balancer. And I mean, we could be like more or less in agreement with what he says, but like if we think about it, like, yeah, physical culture, like there was like all of these things connected very much, like lifting some weights, like moving your body, doing these things, they were connected for on kind of a conceptual level. They were not separated into categories as now. And then, like, yes, like if like doing weight training, like if we're looking for like modern style hand balancing technique as we teach, that is like doing loads of barbell work and dumbbell work is maybe not going to do that much. But for the old school style where you have like more bent arms, you have a further front shoulder position. So it's great. And I mean, both you and me, and I'm sure many of you that listen have seen or maybe experienced that, like, there are people that like they know nothing of hand balancing. They've never tried, and they're pretty just sturdy and muscular. So they manage to hold themselves on the hands by pure force alone almost immediately. And that's like, and for a lot of those people, it'll take a hell of a long time to develop like technique and so on. But there is definitely a connection that they are particularly looking at this old school technique.
I think also we just think about in terms of like GPP versus SPP. So it's basically saying, like, if you have a good general physical preparation, then the specific physical preparation for hand balance isn't too difficult. Mm. And that's, you know, it is one of these things, just like, you know, we've dealt with this as coaches many times. Someone comes to us and goes, I want to learn handstands. Awesome. We will teach you handstands. Or I want to tumble. Awesome. But they've done no other training beforehand. So then they're starting from kind of, the general physical preparation is quite low. So then for us, we have to kind of go, well, your handstands were good, but, you know, doing some push-ups, some dips, some chin-ups, some leg lifts, you know, these things will help a lot at the beginning.
Yeah.
And this is kind of one of those things that, like, it is interesting that, like, back then, my interpretation of it was like, there was only training. There wasn't cross training. There wasn't, you know, endurance training. There wasn't weight training. There wasn't hand balance training. There wasn't tumbling training. There was just training. And someone said, what sort of training do you do? And your answer was yes. That's it. Mm. I train. I get down to the gym. And it's like, if you look at the pictures from the old physical culture gyms, you know, they had weights, they had barbells, they had kettlebells, they had dumbbells, they had weird exercise machines, which we haven't seen come back into vogue yet. They had stall bars, they had ropes, they had mats for tumbling. They had space marked out for wrestling. There's even one of these places in Dublin called Hercules Gym that was set up some, I think, in the 30s, but I'm not certain. And they're kind of, they're still a bit physical culture-ish. Like the gym has full setup for weightlifting, full setup for powerlifting. Lots of bodybuilders train there. The Dublin and Ireland wrestling team trains there. So it still kind of has that embodied physical culture, but it was just, that's the way it was set up. Mm. So it is this kind of thing of like, oh, maybe, you know, and we do see this nowadays. This is the kind of thing, like if we start talking to people, it's like, oh yeah, I'm doing a bit of CrossFit, but then I'm doing a BJJ class and I'm going climbing. People are still doing this kind of mix, particularly in general kind of trends, but then they're not, it's not happening under the same roof, which is the interesting thing. Whereas, like, you can't, you know, you can't go, well, in some places maybe, but you can't go, oh, I'm going to do my tumbling. Oh, cool. Okay, I'm bored with tumbling. Okay, I'll just go climb the wall for a bit. I'll go climb the rope, you know.
Mm.
And this is the thing, like, back to the comment on programming from the last episode, like, people didn't really have a program. They just kind of lifted shit. They just kind of done the thing and then got bored and done something else.
Mm.
There was no, like, mention of sets and reps and other stuff. You know, the only thing you really get mentioned in the old physical culture is like, this man lifted a 300-pound flour sack. It's always just recorded in the feet of who lifted the heaviest. It wasn't recorded in terms of like, oh, this person done 18 reps with 200 pounds. Or, you know, sometimes it's an amazing feat, but it's not really. And people don't note their routines down as well. Whereas, you know, nowadays, if you're reading one of these kind of manuals or someone talking about something, they talk about like, oh, he's doing this, and then I've done a linear progression for that, and then I tapered into this, and I've done that. It's like, no, they just done shit. And that's
it's a very different kind of approach in that, and it's very fascinating to kind of like we talked about seeing it come a bit back in style, but yeah, perhaps not under the same roof.
Yeah,
but
gym that does everything.
Indeed, that's basically what a circus hall is.
Yeah. It's actually one comment in here that's picked up on. Some guy talking about, so he's talking about someone, you know, building his gym or building his building an act. He was like writing an act, he was working on it, and it's training the gym, blah blah blah, working on it, playing a few clubs. At the end of the time, when with the act getting nicely broken in, the talkies came out, and that was curtains for almost the whole vaudeville. And that's true. This is one of the things that like vaudeville and these kind of show hall things and performers, they were the movie stars of the day. Like if you got your break and had a good act that people wanted to see, and this is why it's always one-upping. It's like, I have to be better than what's out there. Because then people want to, you know, show me something I haven't seen before. Is, you know, the old call of the old circus ringmaster. You turn up and like, I've seen that. Show me something I haven't seen before. And now the talkies are coming out, the movies. And that kind of like, it literally did annihilate the whole vaudeville scene. And it is kind of, it's just an interesting one just to think about. It's like, oh, we had this technological advance and now your old way of entertaining yourself is gone. You used to play board games. Now your board game is a tabletop generator on Discord with your friends. You know, it is interesting because like, a lot of these people at the time as well, they went from making bank, they're making a lot of money these kind of shows, a lot of relatives at the time, to essentially being destitute. Like I remember I had a job in the cinema when I worked here as a teen, and the cinema was built inside an old vaudeville show hall theater where they had the theater and they just built two boxes for the cinemas, put the screens in, so they have two screens. But you could go up on top of the roof of the screens and you're inside the theater. You could see all the ornate carvings, all the cool stuff. It's just like, it's just interesting how it's like, oh, they made the call there. It's like, no one wants to go to this stuff anymore, so we're opening a cinema.
Yeah, it's definitely like a different time in a way. I mean, we've had many rounds of, I mean, just to take a stupid one that doesn't like necessarily concern performers in that way, but like the way kind of like the streaming services kind of like annihilated cinema almost, or like
DVD shops.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, yeah, exactly. Those are literally dead. I mean, growing up, like, yeah, you have the CD shops and where like first VHS and then like all of that shit. Like it's so completely changed in such a short time. And I'm sure also like back then we're like, you had this like big thing you could suddenly see cinema. Like it mustn't just have been like, oh yeah, this is another thing to see. It's like the big buzz. And then you had like lots of money behind pushing that. Everyone wanted to see it. And you could show the same reel again and again and again. So yeah, it's completely kind of different thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, like the next chapter that I think is really fascinating as well here, and that we talked a bit about, is like the chapter called Those Hand Balancing Hands. And like you mentioned last time, that this is kind of it's not so much focused on when it comes to modern hand balancing. I mean, we use heel pulls and stuff like that. Like you need enough hand power, but it would be interesting to just see like if just the actual raw force development and endurance of the hand strength could be something that would be a factor for someone who is intermediate or even like advanced levels. Because in the book, like there are some pictures of these like massive forearm development resulting from the exercises as given in the article. And they have a couple of different like exercises here with like various like bands and stuff, but also a lot of just like the finger standing stuff that you do finger stands and five fingers and four fingers when like push-ups and similar stuff.
Yeah.
They also say that like the most popular and best known are the old reliable winding up a weight attached to a string on a piece of broomstick, grasping a light dumbbell by one end and working the other in a circular motion. So like there are like the broom thing. I mean, I made one of like that myself as well.
Yeah. I've got one down in the hall somewhere. Uh-huh. Classic, a wrist roller, classic device. Mm. But yeah, these kind of finger stand things are something that I've actually put them, after reading this, I've actually been putting them into my rotation for the last couple of weeks since the last cast. I was like, okay, I'm going to give this a go. Mm-hmm. Just see where it goes. Kind of interesting, see if it helps with the wrist. But it is just one of these ones, just like, yeah, it is. It seems obvious, but maybe we're caught in the specific physical preparation and just building like fingers like a blacksmith or a railroad brakeman, as the quote here would be an interesting one. But it was like definitely one of the things back in the old physical culture days of like, oh, the man, only man alive to deadlift 700 pounds with one finger and stuff like that. Like it's once again this one upmanship. It's like find your kind of specialization. What am I good at? Okay, I'm a bit better at finger strength than the other guy. So then I'm going to just focus on this and try and make that my thing. And that's kind of, you know, that kind of it's a weird kind of natural selection going on where you have, say nowadays we have kind of set sports where we go, okay, we're going to pick, basically this is what we do in high level sports. We filter people who are really good at something and then specialize, train them. But it's kind of, it's in almost narrow brackets, whereas this was a bit free form. It's like, oh, you know, we see acts when like people are like, I don't know, balancing a cannon on their head back in the day, like a proper full cannon that would launch cannonballs out of cast iron. Why? Because he just figured out it wasn't too hard for him. It wasn't, you know, or not that it wasn't too hard, but my head was able to tolerate more than someone else. So then
I can do this.
Yeah. That kind of thing. So it's like, ah. And then people go and see the guy who could balance a cannon on his head. Could he do much else? Maybe a little bit of everything else. But he was the cannon man. And that's, yeah. You do see this a bit on Instagram as well now. People are kind of, they're not balancing cannons. I suppose like the modern take on a cannon would probably be like, I don't know, a VW Lupo, some like 1 liter car. So I want to see that. I want to see someone balancing a Lupo on their head.
Yep. Give it to me. I am ready for that. Like, there's a cool picture of here too. Like, Bob Jones does a crocodile on thumb and fingertips. So basically, like, finger stand crocodile. Yeah. I've seen finger stand, one arm handstand as well. And I don't think it's extremely hard if you just train up the fingers enough.
You ever tried it? Because you're pretty
good. No, I've never tried it. Like,
the finger stand, handstands, you're pretty good on two arms.
I'm okay. I used to be okay because I used to do them in like cross arms and stuff. But I do think like if I want to start with that now, I should probably just like get back to like plant, like tuck planche and stuff on fingertips, just building some capacity. Because I think it's easy to I wreck my tendons if I go too fast. Yeah. But it would be cool to just try, because I think all I would need is just like the raw force of like the finger position. Because like in a straddle one arm, my balancing ability should be high enough to make that pretty calm. But yeah, like the thumb balancing he does though, that is pretty fucking impressive. And like you see that a lot nowadays in like the calisthenics communities, that like since like now everyone in the calisthenics community and their dog can do full planche, and like okay then like okay can someone do like the two finger full planche, or like the like I've seen like one finger one arm front lever pull up. Like people in that community are really kind of like going in that direction. But like there's some pictures here of Bob Jones doing on just the ground. Like he also does just the thumb stand. And I mean, it must be incredibly hard to balance that. Like, I mean, in a planche, it's hard as hell too. At least your center is low, but like he's doing like an arch-back full handstand here only his thumbs. It's pretty busted.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing, like, I do wonder how long he's balancing these for.
Mm.
Like, the thing in the photos that are taken is, like, the photos are taken with that kind of film that will show movement. You know, it takes, I don't know, a second or two to get the development on the film. Mm. So he's not wobbling because he's not, you know, you do see it in some of the other film photos in the book. You can see there's a bit of, like, ghosting around the image where the person was moving a bit to balance. Whereas these ones, he's dead still. So we can say he's like, he was balancing for about 2 seconds.
Mm.
But was it, that's the kind of thing. This is the thing when you hear about these feats of ye olden days. It's like, was it long enough to get the ta-ta and then done? Or was it just like, yeah, I'm here for 15, 20 seconds?
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if he was there for like a while since like his actual, or like since this is kind of his performance feats, and that like this was supposed to be the, like I'm sure when he walked into the gym and the other guys were there and there was a bit of showing up stuff, like he just kind of imagining that would be important for him to, but yeah, you know, but like this is the ace I have up my sleeve that no one can.
Yeah,
they can be better at me than this and that, but like this one is mine in a way. So I wouldn't be surprised if like they really trained to really have those things. Since that is like so important in of course in all performance context.
Yeah, definitely. there's so much in this.
And
it's like they talk about, like, you know, the strength stuff, but then he goes on and gives like dexterity tests of like moving your fingers and different things, like from the Vulcan hello to like spreading out and trying to get, you know, first getting all these kind of positions nice, hand together, move your index finger, little finger, blah, 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 alternate. But then going like, here's the hard one to try. If that one's easy, try this one.
Mm.
And here's where you get a diploma. You know, these kind of things.
Yeah, it's super cool. And of course, like the book also has like, a lot of chapters about the, like for example, like the hand balance, how and why. So there is much difference between performing a hand balance and merely standing on the hands, as there is between juggling a broom on the palm of the hand and grasping it firmly with fingers and thumb and holding it vertically. So what he means is like that there is a big difference between doing a handstand and standing on the hands. And the big difference is as big as just like balancing a broom in your hand and compared to holding it in the hand vertically. And like that's actually a very good analogy, because if you grab a broom and just hold it in your hand, it's not a problem, but if it's balancing in your palm, you need to constantly kind of like respond to it.
Yeah, exactly. Something else in this chapter, Yeah, there's four phases to the ordinary balance on two hands. The starting position, circling of the hands, the correct position on the hands, and the business of staying in that position. I'd argue that there's five of getting out, but that idea is talking about like just the kick up is like, where do you start? You know, we know this, so we train kick ups, we teach people. If you don't start in the right position, it's not going to be great. If you don't place your hands, circling the hands, in the right position, it's not going to be great. If the entry isn't good, it's not going to be great. If your balancing isn't great, it's not going to last a long time. And yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and it's like...
get the first three, and the struggle is almost over. Yeah.
Yep.
Then, yeah. Inasmuch as not so difficult to learn the correct system of balancing, once you get the idea of getting into the proper position for balancing. That's, you know, it is this kind of thing. Like, we're always talking about, like, setups. Get your setups right before you try to do something else. If the setup isn't good or inefficient, then you're either wasting energy before you get to do your thing, or you're just not going to get to do the thing because you've used the wrong setup. That's one of the things, like, both of us drill home with people we're coaching, and whenever we're teaching, it's just like, this is it. You have to, like, do the first thing first. I can't skip a step.
Yep.
So.
And it's I mean, when they show, of course, like it's with a very arched back, and that they show what they call correct posture, and they do also describe how, like, it's important to like that you're trying to get the skeleton to take as much weight as possible. To not only stay on like pure power anyway. Of course, you're always staying on some power, but that you're trying to limit how much force you use. And it's funny because, like, looking at these pictures, like, most people will say, oh yeah, but this is not efficient at all. Like, that is nonsense. But we were talking about this just before the cast, that like that is kind of nonsense, because it's just that, like, we have to talk about relative absolute efficiency versus relative efficiency. And like since I'm not a physicist and I'm not a mathematician, I'm not gonna like try to make this into numbers, but there is such a thing as an absolute efficiency. It exists, but relative efficiency is for the most part more important, because like the body is an adaptive system that gets good at what it does. So when Bob Jones shows a picture here of an arched handstand and he talks about that as efficient, like, we have to take him seriously. Like, he's experiencing the same stuff as us. It's just that he's trained slightly differently than I am. He's stronger in other muscles than I am, so that, like, that chain will more take over the load in a better way. So similarly, as to if you take a calisthenics bro that can planche until they fall asleep, if they do just an L-sit press to handstand, they will likely lean more in that press than I do. Not because it's worse, but because they have a hell of a lot of power to recruit there compared to from their traps, for example, where I'm strong. So they were speaking about the same stuff. It's just that they were training their efficiency differently. Like, they were lower in the shoulder position. They had the back arch. And what we discussed before the episode two is that both me and Emmett, like, we've both seen, like, I can distinctly remember, though I don't know where it was from, like, a very long video of a handstand contest where people stay for minutes and minutes and minutes. And the winner was some lady who was a contortionist who was just up for like 7+ minutes. And she was in a quite low shoulder position in the stag kind of leg placement. And you'd think that, oh yeah, but that's not efficient. Well, all the other people around her that like had like these stacked nice postures, they fell down way earlier. Yeah. Like, and we're talking way earlier, 4 minutes before her. So, like, what's efficiency then? Like, if they were more efficient, why did she stay up so much longer? Like,
dude, this goes back to like my comments from one of the very past episodes: is the straight line isn't an efficient shape; it's a volatile shape. Meaning it's very easy to change its direction in any way. Whereas it's not actually stable. It's not hard to move. Whereas if you're in a lower center mass shape, like an arched back, split handstand, a stag, the center mass is lower. It's harder to move, but then once it starts moving, it's harder to stop. Whereas the stray one, because it's so volatile, it can move very easily and very quickly. So that's why we think it's efficient, because it requires less power to move it. But that's only because it's volatile. So it's a difference in stability and volatility. And that's kind of, you know, the style of hand balance that is taught nowadays is a very volatile style, because it's very, takes a very little energy to correct it and move it. Whereas, like, if you look at the way they're teaching the one arms in some of them, like, he's talking back a few chapters on the different shoulder placement people were using. And he's talking about, like, some people were, like, twisting the body around. So the offhand shoulder was going towards the supporting hand. And other people were planching the shoulder more forward and turning the opposite direction. Obviously, there was no set technique back then, or no one was, you know, had found this. But they were finding ways to solve the problem themselves. But they were making very stable, locked-in shapes that would just go, okay, balance, and then we have our jacked forearms that will just go and do it. So it is kind of just an interest, whereas nowadays we take shapes that are very volatile, but it means, like, we can correct them very, very rapidly with our fingers. Like, if you look, what I'd really like to do is see some videos of these people balancing and see how many corrections per second they're making. Because, like, I worked it out once, in a one arm you're making somewhere between 5 and 8 corrections a second. If your shape is, particularly in a Swechka, you know, straddle and other stuff. But it is just like, if you look at, because, you know, I've videoed your hands and looked at them, and just, I can see just like little pulses of the fingers, like you're kind of, I don't know, hyper tapping in Tetris.
Exactly.
And that just stays there. And like, if you look at the shape, you're not moving. You're just like, you're just there. But because the shape is so volatile, it just takes a little tap with the finger. Okay, I was going this way, tap with that finger, going that way. And then as you get tired, obviously you default to more longer presses, which require that kind of thing. But it is interesting. Anyway, back onto the thing.
Yeah,
here's
so
the important note. You just got this on page 81. Use all your back while learning. Later, you can readily convert to the almost straight back style, which is best for hand-to-hand work, and which is also favored by German turners and the usual physical education instructors for single balancing. But get into correctly by straightening the small of your back, not by leaving, blah, blah, blah. This so-called continental style is difficult for the chap whose back is not naturally quite stiff. The necessary small of the back action described in the chapter, blah. Anyway, it is just that kind of thing of us, like, he's just basically saying, I think we talked about this at the start, it was like, learn to balance first, then sort your style out. And it is this kind of thing of, like, people do get too caught up sometimes on the, whatever, the preepileptic. I have to have the perfect line before I can balance. It's like, no, learn to balance. You can get your line in another way, and then you can put it into use.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that they talk about here, even if they use kind of the opposite methodology that we would say, learn the straight first and then you can do whatever you want after. And like, I would say from like a modern perspective that like, since the straight handstands require more, like, it's more complex because you need to, like, you need more stuff to be able to do it. Like most people have the enough shoulder flexibility and back flexibility to do some kind of archback handstand if they have the sufficient strength and coordination. But that is not necessarily so for the straight. The straight is like, it requires more stuff. It requires the shoulders to be open. It requires like the elevation of the shoulders, and like there's more things going on there. So there is an argument for learning that. And I mean, of course, that's what we are teaching. We wouldn't default to what they say here because it has utility what we're doing nowadays. But it's really interesting that like for them here, it's like, use all your backbend when learning. That is how they were teaching, and then you convert as you want. One can, like, I mean, there are many what's it called, opinions on this, like, yeah, does it ruin it if you learn it quote unquote wrong at first? And for those who listen, like, you know that we're not like the biggest fans of that theory, and I'm a very good example since like I did everything wrong before I became a hand balancer, and I'm pretty decent. Another thing that like, or one of the things that I find the most fascinating here as well, is that like, that you can convert to the almost straight back style, which is better for hand to hand, and which is favored by the German turners. And it's funny, like in Norwegian, a gymnast is turnet, which is that word, and that's where it comes from like the kind of the German styles of all gymnastics. And then he calls the kind of that straight back style the continental style, which is very, very interesting, since the continental then being like the kind of the European part. And like further down here too, there is a picture of a absolutely straight handstand, something that you'd be like, yep, that's just like exactly how you'd expect a kind of modern handstand to look like. And I'm looking at it right now, and it's like it's super tight. It looks if you put that handstand onto a parallel bar routine in gymnastics or in a circus act, it's like it's there. It's very, very what we would call proper. So it's not like they weren't able to, nor that they didn't know about its existence, but the culture was different. Like the notions, the aesthetics, what they were looking for, the like, it's a different system. That is basically what it is. The value signifiers, the methodology of teaching, what they were looking for and how to teach it, all that was just slightly tweaked in a different direction, even though they were doing very much the same things and were also capable of seeing the use and the differences between all this stuff.
Yeah, there is that tie-in from the Turners, the original Turners, Frederick Ludwig Jahn, physical education coming from the military, being translated, and having this idea, this alert posture, stand at attention, I think it's called, hands down by the side, up straight, as the desired posture. And these kind of things are like, you know, there is, we can't deny the connections between physical culture, nationalism, fascism, in terms of Frederick Ludwig Jahn, like his writings were inspirational to Hitler, to the health of the German people and other stuff. And it is, you know, even if we go into the Chinese stuff where I looked at it, like there was, you know, a lot of their martial arts stuff, like the writing in the martial arts, particularly in the coming out of the Opium Wars and other stuff, was about like reinstalling a national spirit to the health of the people through the correct practice of martial arts and other stuff. And it is, there is this undeniable tie-in to these things. So you have these kind of, particularly in America, it's a bit more freestyle, a bit more liberal at the time, whereas Europe at the time, all of Europe, you know, was having its foray into kind of fascism, even in Ireland, where it was just like, oh, you know, this kind of upright soldier, militaristic posture is a strong thing. We even talked about it with Alex on the anthropology podcast, where he's talking about, like, you know, you don't want people to look relaxed because it makes you look tired. So you want to be upright, and an upright soldier is a strong soldier, you think he said, or something like that.
Yeah.
We should have him back on as well. He was a pretty cool guest.
We should definitely have him back on. He's glorious.
Yeah.
I actually followed another course of his of anthropology not long ago.
Oh, nice.
So I was listening to him ranting as we are ranting into the void now. Nice. And that was great.
Yeah.
Very clever guy.
And then, so this kind of like the continental style, the straightness of the handstand, the desired straightness in the handstand, was it because of efficiency or was it because of like the aesthetic? Like, this is the other thing, in continental physical education, drill marching was part of it. You'd go in and do drill marching. Even my old school, in my old secondary school in Ireland, it's called High School Dublin, and they had the school sergeant. We had a school sergeant when I was there. He was just like the guy who was in charge of all the groundkeepers and looking after those football pitches and other stuff. But his original role in the school was to drill march the boys around the quad. He'd like be there. So instead of PE, the girls would do PE and they'd do whatever they're doing. And at the same time, the boys would be like squad marching in formation around the yard. And this, you know, this school was set, I don't know, 1930s was when it was founded. It was just, it was a thing. And thankfully, most of us got over it. But then it's that. It's like, I'm not going to get into politics. I'll go down ranting.
But like, it's just like another note on that. I think I've said that before on the podcast, but like if you look at all physical education halls in all of Scandinavia, basically, I'm sure in other countries too, they are built after that, the gymnastics ideal. Like they usually have rings hanging from the ceiling. You have the various kind of old apparatus. Of course, you don't have like big parallel bars and all of that, but you have kind of like something similar like to a pommel horse. Like there's a standard that has been around for a long time.
That
also dates back like quite far from what I understand. And many of those schools are built in kind of the 60s. And I'm sure that like that comes from even older on, but like those notions of character building that leads directly into kind of national spirit and so on. It's definitely kind of influential things. And of course, with like speaking of the handstand, which is like, I mean, it is a far stretch to a degree, but there are of course many many other reasons also for the straight taking over time, as we've talked about. He even mentions it here that he says it's better for the hand to hand balancing, and as one of our theories go of that, as tumbling gymnastics and high bar and rings and all these things developed further and further, and gymnastics did a lot of research into just the physics of seeing how to produce maximal power, then the dynamic of the arching and hollow of the body and the core tension and the power that you could produce through mastering the straight position became very important, at the same time as its aesthetics kind of, because in gymnastics, everything is straight. Like there is, there is basically nothing else other than the kind of presenting those pleasurable, like quote unquote, pleasurable lines, either when you twist and flip or when you land, it's all kind of this, you're trying to create this very clear and precise geometry.
Which is weird because their weird like focus, it's almost gone backwards. We're going to straight line geometry, whereas we're doing like curves and spirals in this shit. It's like, I think just where we're getting on, I think for the rest of the book, we've got another four chapters to go through. I think wrapping up now and making a part three is probably going to be the game plan.
I guess so. We have a lot to say here. It's quite fascinating. Just want to say one last thing here before we round up. I was just reading over a little bit. He says that the correct balancing, quote unquote, organ, the correct balancing organ is the palm of the hand, which must learn to feel the balancing points as it shifts forwards and backwards. It is precisely the sensation of balancing a heavy plank on the flat hands at arm's length overhead. The feel of the one hand balance is exactly that of a waiter's hand in balancing a heavy tray of dishes on one hand. So that kind of what he describes then is like the forwards and back of the two arm of like balancing a heavy plank on flat hands overhead, and the waiter's hand balancing a heavy tray of dishes on one hand, like that kind of three-dimensional and organic kind of movement to control the object. And of course, this is then turned backwards and we are the object.
Yeah.
That was my last comment. Bam.
Boom. So there's your cross training for a week. Go work as a server somewhere.
Done. Yes. Goodbye.
The Handstand Cast is brought to you by Handstand Factory and is produced by Motion Impulse. Thanks for tuning in. You can find a full transcript of each episode along with the show notes and any relevant references on handstandfactory.com/podcast. Thanks to Isaac for editing and Jordan for transcriptions. Music by Daniel Horwath. If you want to support the show, you can buy us a coffee on buymeacoffee.com or consider starting one of our Handstand Factory online programs. Links are in the show notes.